My guest today is Jason Dietz. You can find his work over at antiwar.com. It's a site you should visit daily for news. We are going to talk about Ukraine, Crimea, and also Iraq, and how it all ties together. I apologize in advance for the scratchy connection, but try to ignore that and listen to the content.
I guess to start off with, we have Crimea voting overwhelmingly to separate and join the Russian Federation. But to rewind to see why they did that and what happened, we have to look at this crisis. We had a financial disaster predicated on a political disaster. But what really got it going, because it seemed like there was going to be a peaceful resolution, was this sniper fire into the crowd that basically shot all hopes of a peaceful resolution down. And then we had a little news about the sniper fire showing that it wasn't what it seemed, and you wrote about this. There was a leaked call from the ambassador from Estonia or something. Can you explain what was happening with the sniper fire? It seems like an undercover
Sure, it's surprising how little attention this has gotten in a lot of the Western media, but there was a leaked conversation between Estonia's, I believe, foreign minister and Catherine Ashton from the European Union. The Estonian official was just fresh back from Kiev and had met with several people that were involved in the protest, including the chief medic who was on the scene treating sniper wounds. And the medic had been offered a position in the interim government, but she turned it down. And the reason she turned it down was she said that the evidence pointed overwhelmingly to the snipers having been hired by an element within the protesters themselves and had been told to shoot people on both sides to stir up unrest. And she pointed to her evidence for this, which included bullets fired from the same guns that had hit both police and protesters. And it's a really surprising thing, but maybe not so surprising because it worked so well.
Well, it's not even the first time we've seen sniper fire used to kick off something that ended up becoming a disaster later. We saw it in Venezuela and Syria. Not to say they're all the same, but
well, right.
Derailed any chance for peace.
Certainly, once you have the sniper fire, that becomes a game changer, and it gets a lot of publicity. We saw today in the Israeli press them hyping some sniper fire in some Syrian Damascus suburbs, saying that the snipers were intentionally trying not to kill people, but trying to mortally wound them so that they would suffer more and things like that. So sniper fire definitely is something that's rhetorically useful for a protest movement, but to think that they would go to the trouble of actually hiring the snipers themselves and having the snipers shoot people on both sides just to stir up a revolution is really a step farther than I think we've seen most places.
Well, it's suspicious enough as it is, but it's not an isolated incident. You have to look at that on top of John McCain going and visiting the Ukraine, as he does in many coup d'etats, and Victoria Nuland's infamous call.
Right.
Yeah, it says we want Yats in there, and these are the selected bankers we want to have for the new government. And it happens. So with that, together with the sniper fire, it becomes more suspicious. If it had just happened, and the doctor said it seems like somebody shot both people, maybe they weren't hired, maybe that they did that on their own, knowing they could derail the peace process. But hired by who? Would it be the EU? Would it be the CIA? Would the National Endowment for Democracy? Who would be the paymaster there?
Well, it's something we probably won't ever find out, but it could be any of those. It could just be some of those more neo-Nazi-aligned protest groups in the Ukraine that certainly showed up to the protests, even when they were simply peaceful protests, spoiling for a fight. You see, on the one hand, the protesters that were supportive of Klitschko and people like that who came dressed, you know, just like normal people. And then on the other hand, you've got these people that are, you know, wearing stormtrooper helmets and wielding clubs and chains. And I mean, they came to the protests ready for a fight.
It is bothersome that actually, usually when people pull out Godwin's Law or talk about Nazis, it's an exaggeration. But in this case, no, that's pretty much exactly what it was. Actual neo-Nazis. Stefan Bandera loving neo-Nazis. But it's not that shocking considering how much we've backed Al-Qaeda and Al-Nusra and Jandala and equally nefarious groups who murder people and do every bit of grotesque things that Nazis used to do. So neo-Nazis aren't so bad compared to that.
Oh, sure. And a lot of the former Soviet Union does have these elements. These neo-Nazi groups, we saw a big rally of Nazi-era veterans today in Latvia. 1,500 people or so, according to some of the reports, that were veterans fighting on the side of the Nazis against the Soviets during World War II. And there's a lot of that sentiment that among those former Soviet republics that the Soviets were the worst of the World War II combatants. And I guess that it's awfully hard to make a case one way or another on who was worse because they were both so terrible. But
isn't there a choice?
it certainly should be. But it seems like...
They're like Republicans and Democrats.
Exactly. It seems like for a lot of them, the grass is greener on the other side, and they didn't live under Nazi rule for very long, but they lived under Stalinist rule for decades, so I guess they assume it couldn't have possibly been any worse.
I guess it's one of those psychological things where it's the enemy of your enemy is your friend sort of thing, but they're not alone in that. I mean, you see that kind of thinking in many countries where people constantly vote against their own interests because they think, well, Team B is slightly less worse than Team A. I don't know how many times I heard in the last election, I'm picking the lesser of two evils. They just already gave up and assumed, well, we have to pick evil, so I'm going to pick the lesser of two evils.
I don't think you'd get a modern democracy off the ground if you didn't have that lesser of two evils mentality going for such a big part of the voting public.
Yeah, that seems to be the case. And that seems to be the case of why the main situation Ukraine was in is, are we going to be up to or above our head in debt to the EU or to Russia? Which sounds like less of a disaster. And neither wasn't an option.
Ukraine's historically, well, not that Ukraine has a very long history, but since the collapse of the Soviet Union, it's sort of been pulled between being part of the European Union's sphere of influence or the Russian sphere of influence. And there's certainly a case to be made for either economically, but it seems like if they had been able to sort of stay in the middle and trade with both sides instead of having to constantly choose between a government that's completely hostile to Russia and constantly trying to pick a fight or completely hostile to Europe, it seems like they might have been better off.
Well, it seems like each leader has sold them down the river, and now it looks like they're going to be beholden to the IMF, which may be the worst of any choice. But nobody's really stood up for the Ukraine, but a disturbing thing I see is people just kind of picking sides, either being completely pro-Putin, which is scary, or the opposite, completely in bed with the EU, which is just as scary, and not really looking at what happened to all this money, these 15 billion euros, where did it go, what did they spend it on?
Right, and the answer to a lot of it is fuel. a lot of those debts that Ukraine's accrued over the years are natural gas and oil and things like that, and mostly to the major Russian oil and gas companies.
Gazprom.
Right. Gazprom alone has $1.9 billion in Ukraine's debt.
Now, Crimea is an autonomous region, or supposed to be, but the press has treated it just like part of Ukraine. How independent is it from Ukraine? And with them breaking away, do they still owe Ukraine's debts, or now that's all on the rest of Ukraine?
Well, it's not really clear what happens now. It was pretty independent, and even during the waning years of the Soviet Union, Crimea had a status as nominally independent from the rest of the Ukraine Socialist Republic. But
it had its own parliament.
Right.
Had its own prime minister briefly. That is a weird, it's hard to find comparisons, really.
Well, there are some. I guess we could look at Iraqi Kurdistan as somewhat similar. The region around Venice in Italy has some nominal autonomy, too. Nothing's exactly the same as the Crimea's status in Ukraine, but a lot of the split there is that Crimea was not historically part of the Ukraine. It just sort of got folded into it in the middle of the Soviet era. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, it found itself as sort of a subject nation under Ukrainian rule when there was no historical basis for that to be the case.
True, and they have a lot of ethnic Russians living there now, and it was primarily they who voted to separate. We see the West saying this is illegitimate.
Allowing people to vote? The selected government is calling
this democratic process.
Right.
Undemocratic. Whereas they were in power for how many hours based on pure violence?
Well, and it's, of course, it's entirely opportunistic for the West, because when the pro-Russian government was still in power in Ukraine, there was a similar secessionist movement sort of getting started in Lviv in the far west of the Ukraine, and nobody in the West said anything about that. There was no criticism of calls for them to split off and form their own nation.
Well, I mean, it is a kind of, depends on your ideology, really. It could be dangerous to just allow all these different ethnic groups to start voting away chunks of their country into a bunch of little countries. I don't think people ought to be voting based on their ethnicity anyway. But I don't think that's all that was at stake here. I mean, it happened to be a lot of ethnic Russians voting to join Russia, but I'm sure people were sick of living under perpetual debt probably their entire lives. And then looking at the gloomy economic situation, decided it's better to join one of these big teams than to be caught in a tug of war.
Right, and we saw some interviews to the extent that people inside Crimea were interviewed at all about what they thought about the split. You see a little old lady, I believe it was on MSNBC, talking about, you know, she's a retiree who gets $100 a month from the Ukraine government, but with their debt, they're not really sure how long they can pay that. Where if Crimea becomes part of Russia, she thinks she's going to get more like $300 or $400 a month. So, and Russia is, of course, not buried under a mountain of debt where that would be in jeopardy. So you can see where there's economic incentive, certainly, to join a team that's, if not the winning team, at least not the the biggest loser.
Yeah, Europe's economy is very questionable. But they seem to do it on purpose. I mean, most of it in Greece and the other areas is a lot to do with predatory lending.
Although, right. Greece especially. It's incredible that their economy has survived as long as it has.
Well, I mean, surviving is about, if that's the right word. It certainly hasn't been thriving, and that's not over. They just keep getting more and more loans, which is not a way to pay off a loan to get another loan. It seems to be the situation that the EU was offering, but under conditions that were just unacceptable. I mean, what did they think Ukraine was going to do? And it wasn't like the other option was, well, then go get a massive loan from Russia. They're wondering what could have been done to avoid all of this. Or was the writing already on the wall?
Well, I think to some extent, the way global economics is these days, the writing probably was on the wall. And Ukraine is not energy rich. They're going to have to import a lot of things, and they're going to be pretty poor as a result of it. But I think they really haven't worked on fostering any sort of export industries of their own apart from agriculture.
Yeah, Japan imports about 95% of its fossil fuels, but they have a massive export industry. And you can pay for it, but it's really sad then. I wonder if they could have been the middleman and say, oh, you want these pipelines to go through here? Or something, but I don't know if it's just that or if a lot of the money hasn't been squandered.
Well,
the leadership they've had.
That's definitely happened too. But I'm not sure how you can avoid that in those sort of post-Soviet economies where you end up with these oligarchs that have just huge economic and political clout and can basically loot what they want to loot.
Well, that happened in Russia itself.
Oh, absolutely.
Over 1 million people starving to death during the transition with the oligarchs and Yegor Gaidar in charge while Yeltsin was lost in a big vat of vodka. I mean, he literally was, he was in the hospital for a year, he was in and out, and he was a drunk, there's no way around it, he drinks more than Joe Biden. I think a lot of that history is missing with the oligarchs, when people talk about the oligarchs. I'm not sure everyone understands how that happened, with the collapse, and who are these oligarchs? You know, oligarchs, one thing, they know what the word means, but I'm not sure people really grasp how that transition led to oligarchs with the voucher system and the fake court cases, the rigged cases that just awarded giant assets from the former communist regime to individuals.
Right.
Against each other.
Buying enormous state industries for not even pennies on the dollar, but dramatically less than that. And ending up with these huge empires.
Yeah, some of them have died, but a lot of them still live in the UK or Israel, which refuse to extradite anybody to Russia anyway. And Putin threw some of them in jail, which is why, like Khodorkovsky, that's why a lot of Russians love him. Like, he's just a hero riding an angel or something. Even though he's in KGB and kills journalists and Chechens and everything else, he got rid of the oligarchs. Most of them, the ones that went against them anyway.
Right, and that's the key to the whole thing, is that he got rid of the ones that were against his own interests, but clearly he didn't completely try to purge the oligarchs entirely, because he could have never pulled that off.
No, not even with Kaczynski Group and the Moss Group and Bank. He didn't have enough power to do that, but that's lost on people. There's a lot of Putin worship. I don't know if he looks cool shirtless riding a bear or doing judo or what it is, but they love him. I mean, he can do no wrong. And it is tempting, I guess. People really want that leader on a hill, that hero or somebody, because it feels good to have somebody oppose Western intervention, as in Syria and other places, even though it's not because they care about people in Syria, it's because it's in Russia's own interest, but people really need that iconic figure, because they need a good guy or they need a hero in these times. And I guess Putin fulfills that role.
Well, and his actions in the Crimea were not selfless either, of course. Russia's navy has been based out of Sevastopol for centuries now. And it was pretty cynical the way that the, much like the West shrugs off secession when it's in their own interests, seeing that there was some support for Crimean secession and joining Russia, it was a pretty easy thing to just back that and make it sort of an undercover takeover of the peninsula.
They went in with troops that did not have the Russian insignias. And I wonder if the reason for that wasn't just to mock the West, because the National Endowment for Democracy, they're not wearing insignias. Financing the protest and protesting themselves. I couldn't think of another reason for it. Everyone clearly knew it was Russian troops.
Right.
Which they have a treaty to do. They had every right to do that anyway.
Well, right. And even today, Ukraine's defense ministry says there are 22,000 Russian troops in the Crimea, which is still a bit under what they're allowed to have there by treaty. They're allowed to have up to 25,000 troops there.
Right, since 1997. I forget the treaty's name, but that was the year.
Yeah, one of those treaties that on the naval base.
Right, and so it's easy for us to take a calm look at this and say, look, we're not on team whatever, but these are the facts and this is what's happening. That was not an invasion, but we saw a news anchor quit from Russia today over what she thought was a military occupation and invasion, which is ironic given all the actual military occupations and invasions that are simultaneously happening under the U.S. banner, like Afghanistan.
Right. It's definitely something less than a military invasion and occupation, but it's not exactly something that was entirely organic that Russia just sort of got swept up into. Clearly there was a lot of interest in getting the Russian Unity Party within the Crimea into positions of power there so that they could push this referendum in a hurry while the getting was good.
Well, we have an oligarch on one side and the Russians on the other side. Oligarch in Ukraine is backed by... There are a lot of neo-Nazis in the cabinet.
I don't know there are.
I mean, it's very worrisome. I'm worried about the ethnic Russians who live in Ukraine, as well as the Jews and everyone else they hate.
Right, and it's remarkable how the U.S. has tried to downplay it. Like, oh, there's not that many neo-Nazis in the Ukraine's interim government, and they're not that anti-Semitic, but...
I don't know if you listen to some of the speeches they were giving.
Right, and we had an interview yesterday with, I think it was a McClatchy paper, did an interview with one of the leaders of the right sector, and he was saying, well, I can't be anti-Semitic because there's a half-Jew that is my son's godfather. But then the whole rest of the interview was about Jewish oligarchs that are pro-Russian, and he was clearly not on message for if he was trying to sell the idea that the right sector is not neo-Nazis.
Well, he's like a lot of races where the one he's related to is one of the good ones.
Right.
Oh, he's one of the good ones. It's amazing. If someone had asked me if that was ever going to happen, and you haven't heard much from Israel either. They seem to be supporting the U.S. on this, too. They could care less how much backlash that could have in the future, supporting Nazis into a government.
Right. It's not like that has a great history of working out in the past. And I think perhaps the funniest part of it is that the U.S. official who was leading the they're not that anti-Semitic charge was Ira Foreman, who's the ambassador for anti-Semitism for the United States, that we actually have our own ambassador just for that. And, you know, mostly that job involves going to banquets and things like that and talking about the horrors of the past. But this is sort of the first time that since that post was created, and I believe that was a Bush era creation, this is sort of the first time since that creation that it really had any sort of current meaning that you actually had.
Job.
I mean, it is.
Ambassadors for every other kind of racism, like ethnically cleansing Palestinians, perhaps.
I don't think. I think that's an exclusive thing. I've never heard of another ambassador for a single cause like that.
That just seems weird. It's somebody has as part of the payroll and everything to go not be anti-Semitic.
But then this is
that is weird because then you need a lot more than that.
Yeah, and this was sort of the one time in the history of that post that you've got serious neo-Nazis taking considerable positions of power in an interim government, and all they have to say is it's not that bad.
Well, I think that just shows you how much a lot of that do-gooder label stuff of preventing racism or liberating women in the case of Afghanistan and that kind of rhetoric that we hear is just there as to put a good face on things that are much nastier. It's whatever is politically expedient is what's accepted, but
oh, absolutely.
Obviously, they're not going to say, well, we want these resources and we want this money and we want... They never tell you that. They say, well, we're helping so-and-so, some minority, the Kurds in Iraq or something, and totally disingenuous.
And the whole argument that the Crimean referendum was a violation of international law was just sort of a cynical argument based on what would benefit the West at the time. I mean, they obviously don't want Crimea to secede now because now there's a pro-Western government in charge.
And how about Kerry's speech? I know it's just hard not to make fun of him. He said it was so 19th century in that you just can't invade nations based on very false pretexts or flimsy. Meanwhile, today, 46 killed in Iraq, which is now and has been since January, shelling Fallujah, one of their own cities.
Right, and making no real progress towards retaking it.
And it's just, when we say Fallujah, that's what we mean. Not a base or something, just the city.
Right, it's a city of a couple hundred thousand people. And a surrounding area of villages with tens of thousands more.
Bombed. And then, supposedly the pretext for that as well, we're fighting Al-Qaeda. But Iraq has lost around 1 million people, if you include the 500,000 that starved to death between the two wars. And there were, I think, 50 killed the day before, 40 before that, 40 before that. It's every day now. And that's because of an occupation and a military invasion that was based on false pretexts. One of the biggest liars to sell that war was Robert Kagan. And his wife is Victoria Nuland, who made the infamous call about Ukraine. So it comes full circle. And I'm just wondering how they can get up with a straight face on television and say these things, and why nobody of all these hairdo talking heads calls them out on it.
Well, I think on the one hand, you have a lot of people in these positions as interviewers that seem to just worship power for its own sake, and anybody that's got any sort of official position, they're going to take what they say, no questions asked. But I think for the rare cases where they would be inclined to ask a tough question, they're not going to be in a position to be an interviewer very long if they do that.
That's true. It's being a yes man is how you get promoted. And so there's probably a lot of self-censorship. It just seems like if you had any moral bones in your body, you know, when people could be dying or are, that's more important than advancing your career. I mean, they're already there. They already have the position. So at some point, they could pull a 180. I don't know. My naivete.
Well, and some of them might well tell themselves that someday they're going to be in a position where they're going to do that. But as they get further and further along in their career, they're constantly finding reasons to hold off on that for a little while longer.
Mm-hmm. It is sickening, though. I mean, it's across the board in mass media, and we see them reading the same catchphrases. It's as if we have state-run media. I mean, it might as well.
It really is. I mean, with issues like the Ukraine and the Crimea, we don't have serious debate on any of the national news channels. They present the official U.S. position without any real questioning of it, and they occasionally will present just enough of Russian position to mock it. But actual Russian state media like RT, you actually do find a little bit of debate. I mean, they're certainly skewed as well, but they actually do have some real debate going on there.
But that might be because they're not the ones supporting neo-Nazis, and they're the ones that hadn't, you know, people actually vote to bring Russia in, so they don't have to lie as much.
Right, they're in
the situation, because they actually might be less wrong.
Right, they're in the convenient position here of having a good justification for everything that they're doing. Even if some of their actions are being done with less than noble intentions, there are at least valid excuses for saying, well, we have to protect the ethnic Russians in the Crimea. When before the Russian troops started deploying, you started seeing attacks on pro-secessionist protesters.
Well, that's something, too, before this whole crisis started. There was, ever since the collapse of the Soviet Union, there's already been a lot of attacks on ethnic Russians and prejudice towards Russians because of, you know, collectively, because of what Stalin did, or, you know, what, how Russia as a government had treated Ukraine. The people who were living there have faced a lot of prejudice. That's been something going on, I guess, in the dark for a long time.
It wasn't me. Oh, absolutely. But I think we're starting to see the consequences of that sort of persecution in the long run is places like the Crimea where there are ethnic Russian majorities just saying when things get too bad that they're willing to break off and rejoin the Russian Federation.
I wonder how that sat with John McCain at night.
Well, not very well, because ever since his last visit to meet with some of the neo-Nazis that were leading the protests, he's been talking about increasing sanctions on Russia and increasing military aid for the Ukraine. Which
the four horsemen chaos wherever he goes.
Right, he visits Syria and he just happens to meet with some kidnappers. And he visits Ukraine and he just happens to meet with somebody who's going to give a huge neo-Nazi speech just a few hours later. I don't know if he's got the worst publicist in the world or what, but it seems like wherever he goes, he's meeting with the worst possible people to make his case that we're supporting the good guys.
Yeah, he's a hardline Zionist as well. His father helped cover up the USS Liberty attack. It's in his genes or something. I personally think it's not bad luck. I think he just ideologically agrees with these crazies because he's crazy. I mean, he did live in a cage in Vietnam for over a year. I mean, it's got to do something to you.
That's true.
I mean, he's got a raging case of post-traumatic stress disorder. It's amazing that he keeps getting elected. I don't know how that happens. He's a monster.
Well, and his pushes for military aid to the Ukraine are just nonsensical. I mean, even Ukraine's own interim government, which these aren't the most stable or rational people in the world, a lot of them, but even they're saying, you know, there really isn't a military option here. Russia's military is a lot bigger than the Ukraine's, and they're not going to fight a war over the Crimea.
What are you
where
talking
they're going
about bringing nuclear weapons back to Ukraine?
Well, so, some of them have talked about that, and that might be a...
That although it's a horrible idea.
Let's right.
Cuban Missile Crisis. Let's, you know, let's roll the dice with nuclear war. Why not?
And if you think countries are uncomfortable with Iran having a civilian nuclear program with some questions surrounding it, imagine if the Ukraine, with a government including neo-Nazi factions, up and says we're making nuclear weapons. I mean,
or
what is that?
If they brought them in from another country and put them there, even like, not only would they have nuclear weapons, imagine a country with neo-Nazis with nuclear weapons that's also 15 billion euros in debt.
Right. It's about the worst case scenario. It sets up so many crises in the years to come that it's unimaginable.
But I guess for a neocon, that's the how you sell it. It's gonna make crises. You know, or if you're Rahm Emanuel, you're like, okay, that means opportunities. Going off his quote, you know. I can't believe he was so honest. I mean, we know that. We know politicians take advantage of crises and they see them as opportunities. But he actually said it. So, he's just like, what? He owned it. But, you know, looking at John McCain makes you say, it was a bad choice there. I mean, Obama's been a warmonger and everything else, too, but a lot better than a little Igor there.
Right. We could well have already had World War III by now.
It can always go lower.
And
Palin, what's it? That was his running mate, right?
Right. You never think that the next time is going to be worse, but somehow it always manages to be. And even then, the one that wins the election seems a bit preferable to the one that loses.
Yeah, but only because it's dirt sandwiches sort of thing. But McCain Palin, that is really scary. I mean, that almost happened.
It did.
In the primaries, like, how does that happen? How we got? You thought Bush was embarrassing? Wait a minute. I'm not an Obama fan by any means. He's basically been George Bush's third and fourth term. He's actually increased most of the policy, the worst things, plus the NSA run wild and everything else. But it could go lower. And I'm wondering now about what's going to happen in the next election with Hillary and some of these other scary people. Are we ever going to get out of this?
It doesn't seem like it.
The system's the same as Ukraine. I mean, they keep getting people who sold them down the river, and we keep getting a bunch of imperialists.
Right, and if there is a difference between our system and the Ukraine system, it's that whoever happens to be in power at the time isn't necessarily going around in mass arresting whoever was in power before.
No,
so
pardon them instead.
Right, they're sort of more conciliatory, but they still just take their 8-year terms and swap back and forth.
Yeah, I wish there was a way around it, but I guess, you know, what you're doing is the best way to start at it, and that's to work for independent media and get the word out, and so slowly more and more people can get access to real news and make better and more informed decisions. Hopefully we can get more, I don't know, Ron Paul, Kucinich type, you know, sane people in government, but it just seems like such a long road uphill right now.
It does. It seems never ending.
But I think it's much better than it was in the past. I don't know if people realize it or not, how bad it used to be. But pre-internet, it was far worse than it is today. At least they know
right,
what's going on.
There would be no NSA scandal without the internet. I mean, not to the extent that it has been. There would never have been a major media outlet covering this. I really don't think that...
Plus, they literally couldn't spy on your email if you didn't have internet.
Well, that's true, too. But I really think that without the internet, you wouldn't see a lot of the coverage, even when whistleblowers do come forward, because it's a lot easier to keep a few well-placed media outlets from running a story.
Well, it's like I said with the killings in Baghdad. That's from antiwar.com. You get it from independent sites. That would never be on TV. You're never going to see Wolf Blitzer, former AIPAC employee, up there talking about how many people died in Iraq today in a war we shouldn't have been in. That's never. That war's over as far as TV's concerned. And that's a very disturbing thing. All these wars we start, including even Korea and Vietnam, was still Agent Orange everywhere in Vietnam, for example. The war didn't really end, and people are still suffering. And yet, it's out of sight, out of mind. Like, we came home, war ended. And not right, looking at the real consequences.
The Iraq War ended on the high note of MSNBC having the footage of the last few trucks crossing into Kuwait, and then everything was just supposed to be fine. And if that was where you're getting all your information from, you might have heard about Al-Qaeda taking over Fallujah. It wasn't a big story, but they did mention it. But other than that, you really didn't hear about Iraq since then.
Where all the suffering. How many people have died in the internal conflicts and in the actual war and starvation and other, preventable diseases and everything else that happened as a consequence of the war, of both wars, really.
And the only reason they even really mentioned the Fallujah thing was so that the hawkish politicians could get on afterwards and say that this proves we shouldn't have left when we did. As though Fallujah hadn't already been overrun by Al-Qaeda while we were there one time, and
well, probably bombing the hell out of it didn't win the hearts and minds either.
Right.
I mean, if somebody bombed my city, I'm going to join whoever is against them.
Right. All the same problems that are happening today in Iraq are, in the first place, a lot of them are because of the U.S. occupation, and in the second place, continuing the U.S. occupation wouldn't have changed anything. If anything, it would have made a lot of the problems even worse.
Well, they keep supporting Al-Qaeda right next door in Syria. So, I mean, they get all these weapons and money because of this new conflict, and they just walk across the border into Iraq and go to Fallujah, and they got all the funding and weapons they need.
All right, and Iraq's government has been surprisingly willing to admit just how powerful Al-Qaeda's gotten because of Syria. When they first moved into Fallujah and they were trying to justify their shelling the city, their argument was basically that Al-Qaeda is so well armed now, if they don't keep them on the defensive, they could basically march 50 miles down the road and attack the capital city and have a reasonable shot of taking it over.
Can you imagine that? Like, re-invade Iraq? How well would that go over?
I think that would be pretty unpopular.
But still, I mean, there's aid to Al-Qaeda or al-Nusra, and the same kind of bunch of killers and kidnappers and organ eaters and everything, and I guess it's just not on TV, but the outrage isn't there. I know an outright military intervention again, like that, as what got rejected for Syria, that would be opposed, but this proxy war scenario seems to go on unfettered, nothing happens. And I guess it's just a lack of access to information. People aren't aware of what's really happening in Syria.
Yeah, and I still think that in the long run, they're going to push for another direct involvement in Syria. And it does seem like, whenever Kerry talks Syria or one of the White House officials talks Syria, they've kind of got a chip on their shoulder about having been denied that opportunity for an invasion last year, and I think there's still some hope among them that they can come up with a good pretext where they can sell that war again.
It's hard to me. Look at their neighbor Israel, who just started bombing Gaza again. They are guilty of everything that Syria is accused of. Openly, not even trying to hide it. I mean, it's, yeah, we bombed them again. Yeah, we built colonies for our chosen race or whatever. Schools and roads and everything. And that doesn't matter. I mean, that's just outright racism. That's outright racism. And we get full support and money from the United States. And so all these pretexts about helping minorities and all that, it's just nothing but lies. Nothing but lies. You can't simultaneously support racial colonization and say, well, we're here to help the little man.
Well, apparently you can, and apparently some people will believe you because they keep doing it, and at least to some extent they get away with it.
Like, they kind of associate with them religiously or something. I think, like, there's another layer there, but people aren't that stupid. There's some other kind of way they get hooked, and they can kind of excuse Israel because they associate it with religious history, not actual history, but their version of, you know, God as a real estate agent or whatever. But, yeah, it just blows my mind, man. But I thank you for all your work, and I continue to read you on antiwar.com and other sites, posts, etc. And so keep at it, and thanks for coming on the program today.
Sure, thank you for having me.